From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today, you'll hear about Disney's takeover of the Hulu streaming service and what it means for the company and consumers. Then, South Korean director Bong Joon-ho is a master of genre, but what exactly is his Oscar-nominated film, Parasite? Horror, drama, comedy, all three, or none of the above?
My goal is always making funny movie.
And the Oscar-nominated costume designer for Jojo Rabbit knows how to dress for success. It's The Frame. We'll be right back. As part of its $71 billion deal to acquire assets from 21st Century Fox a year ago, the Walt Disney Company ended up with a controlling interest in the streaming service Hulu. Disney subsequently bought out Comcast's share of Hulu, and now Disney has announced it will assume much closer management of the streaming service. It's all part of the studio's aggressive move into streaming. Lucas Shaw covers media and entertainment for Bloomberg, and he's here to sort out how Hulu figures into Disney's future. Lucas, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
Hulu previously had been more or less a standalone operation, and Disney now is, I guess, bringing Hulu closer under its own control. What does that mean long term, and why does Disney feel it needs to control Hulu more directly?
It's kind of a short-term pain for long-term gain scenario where you're going to see it having to ingest a company with a very different culture. But Disney is a company that really likes to control soup to nuts. It's an organization that is run in a very hierarchical fashion. CEO Bob Iger, who's been, you know, one of the kind of great media and entertainment executives of this century, has very hands-on approach with a lot of these a lot of his assets. Kevin Mayer, who's running all of Disney's streaming businesses, is also pretty hands-on. And my understanding is that the two of them would like to be a lot more involved in the strategic direction of Hulu. You know, if you look historically, because Hulu had multiple owners, it was this very weird situation where it had a CEO and it was independent and made a lot of the decisions on its own and it was run separately. But this, being the CEO of Hulu, was kind of a thankless job because you had control to a point. And that point was if it required a lot of spending or it was a real kind of strategic initiative, you needed the approval of your board members who were different media companies with kind of clashing priorities, and they often struggled to agree on anything. Having kind of one company and then one or two people in charge of all of the streaming operations, not just Hulu, but Hulu and Disney and ESPN, allows for a cohesive strategy as Disney tries to kind of plot its course forward in this new world.
Hulu obviously does not have as many subscribers as Netflix, but it has made some material gains. How has Hulu done over the last year or so in terms of subscribers? And is it clear what its identity is going to be within the Disney universe?
It's doubled its subscribers more or less in the last 3 years. It's now north of 30 million subscribers, which is much smaller than Netflix in the U.S., kind of about half the size, but still very strong. And it's been growing more quickly than Netflix the past couple of years, because as Netflix has reached something of a saturation point, Hulu has seen an opportunity. Now, some of that has been through investments in original programming, the popularity of a show like The Handmaid's Tale. Some of it is through really steep discounting. I mean, Hulu's done these Black Friday deals where you can get a year subscription for like $1 a month. And that's really helped. As for kind of where it fits in Disney, I think it is both clear and unclear. I know that's sort of a cop-out answer, but look, Hulu is the home for more adult programming relative to what is on Disney Plus. So all the shows from a place like the FX cable network, which has kind of more violent, more mature themes, those fit on Hulu. They don't fit on Disney Plus. Disney is very protective of, you know, the quote unquote Disney brand, and that stands for family friendly entertainment. And there's a lot of programming that will work in a streaming environment that comes from different divisions of both Disney and Fox that might not work on Disney Plus, but works quite well on Hulu. But I think Disney will have these kind of tricky questions with certain projects as to what fits where. And it's why I assume the company will really push this more bundled offering where you get Hulu and Disney Plus together.
I'm curious how Disney looks at streaming as an overall business. Disney, as a movie studio, has focused on brands like Marvel and Lucas and Pixar. How important is streaming going forward with Hulu, Disney Plus, ESPN, in terms of the company's overall future strategy?
It's really, really important because Disney is a public company. Public companies get measured by investors based on kind of their future growth potential. And Disney had run into this tricky point where even though its movie business was dominating Hollywood, the cable TV business, which had been one of, if not its most important growth engine for many, many years, was starting to sputter because of cord cutting, because of Netflix and all of this competition. And so it has sold Wall Street on the idea that streaming is going to be that engine going forward, much as Netflix has made a ton of money, or at least its market capitalization has increased by billions of dollars because of its growth. Disney now wants to kind of draft off a similar phenomenon. And we've seen it. I mean, every time Disney has reported its financial results in the past couple of years, it has been able to sort of distract people from whatever the underlying numbers are about the business with some kind of shiny new toy about what's happening in streaming. Everything from the fact that there was going to be a streaming service to some of the shows to the fact that it was taking movies off of Netflix. And this has really pleased Wall Street. And so far it's working because Disney Plus seems like a big success.
Let's talk about another publicly owned company. It's called Alphabet. It's the parent of Google, and it also owns YouTube. And Alphabet, up until now, has not released the numbers for YouTube, and now it has. So two questions. Why did it decide to start releasing financials about YouTube? And second, and more important, what do those financials say about YouTube's business?
There's been clamor for it for a long time because YouTube is now so big that investors want to know more. The media obviously wants to know more. The SEC often or will sometimes require disclosures at a certain point. It's not clear that happened here. Maybe Alphabet and the parent company of Google just wanted to show that they had this really fast growing business, because that's what the numbers show. You know, YouTube reported about $15 billion in ad sales this past year. And it's growing at a rapid pace. That $15 billion is a little below what a lot of analysts had thought. They projected it would be closer to, you know, $18 or $20 billion this year. But it grew from kind of $11 or $12 billion the year before to $15 billion in 2019 and will continue to grow in the years ahead. It is a growth opportunity for what has been a maturing business.
Lucas Shaw covers media and entertainment for Bloomberg. Lucas, always great to have you on the show. Thanks for coming back.
Likewise. Thanks, John.
Coming up on The Frame, Parasite could become the first foreign language movie ever to win the Best Picture Oscar. We talk with its director and co-writer, Bong Joon-ho. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn, and today we're revisiting my conversation with South Korean filmmaker Bong Joon-ho. Parasite, which he directed and co-wrote, could make history this Sunday as the first foreign language film to win the Best Picture Oscar. This past weekend, Bong Joon-ho won the Original Screenplay Prize from the Writers Guild of America, and earlier, the Screen Actors Guild honored Parasite with its award for outstanding performance by a cast. Bong, who is also nominated for Best Director, spoke with me at the Telluride Film Festival. The filmmaker was with his translator, Sharon Choi. And as we watched people enter the theater where Parasite was about to be shown, I was curious to ask him if he ever goes to see his films with the general public.
한국에서 한번 이렇게 모자 이렇게 싹 가가지고.
So I actually did go to a theater in Korea once. I wore a hat and I was very sneaky about it. And I watched the film amongst the audience and it was a very fun experience. I got to see their responses immediately and I felt a sense of pleasure from it.
그리고 나 자신이 이렇게 옆에 관객한테 내가
And I also felt this compulsion to almost spoil the story for the audience sitting next to me as well.
I want to ask you about Parasite, because my understanding is you originally wrote it for theater and not for film. Is that right?
So it wasn't as if I wrote the script for a theater production, per se. I originally came up with the idea, toying with how it would be to put two houses on stage, and that was how the idea began. But I quickly realized that film is the right medium for me. And so from the very first beginning, I wrote the script for the screen.
So when you say two houses on top of each other, kind of upstairs, downstairs, does that mean the idea for this movie comes to you visually first, that maybe the rich family is up here and the poor family is down there, and then you fill in the story? Do you see it first before you start to write it?
그러니까 이미 시나리오 쓸 때 공간들의 구조에 대해서 많이 설계를 했어요.
So because I'm a writer and director, even from the script writing stage, I already had all the structures of the spaces in mind. They were already pre-designed as I was writing the script. And for Snowpiercer, the class was divided with the tail cars and the front cars. And with this film, I wanted to align different classes vertically.
I'll just jump in here. In his 2013 film Snowpiercer, Bong Joon-ho created this dystopia on a train where the haves and the have-nots are clearly separated by the front and back of the train. And at one point, a character played by Tilda Swinton visits the unruly class in the back and lays down the law.
Order is the barrier that holds back the frozen death. We must all of us on this train of life remain in our allotted station. We must each of us occupy our preordained particular position.
In Parasite, the divisions are defined not by train cars, but by real estate, how nice your home is, and in Korea, whether or not your place has a basement.
특히 한국은 좀 지하실이 미국 가정보다 지하실이 좀 더 드문 편인데.
In Korea, compared to homes in the States, basements are very rare, and I think basements provide a lot of layers that you can't quite always predict. I think when poor people look at rich people, you always get a sense that we don't know everything about the rich. For poor families, everything seems to be exposed, but there's this lack of information that you feel regarding rich people. You always feel like there's secrets and layers to them that we can never discover.
When you have an idea in your mind of what the places they're living in look like, and then you go to find those places, it can sometimes be difficult. The house that a lot of this story unfolds in is an amazing piece of architecture, and it's also separated from the rest of the world just by a door, that there is this kind of rich person's utopia on one side and the ordinary world right behind it. How important was it for you to find the right house? Because the house is almost its own character in this movie.
집이 정말 중요한 캐릭터고 뭐 특히 부잣집이 영화의 한 60%.
As you said, the houses are very important characters in the film, in particular the rich house. Most 60% of the story happens in that house. So we actually built the houses. We knew from the beginning that it would be impossible to find the locations. So with the production designer, we built the houses on set.
Even the whole neighborhood, the poor town, is all rebuilt. And also 문하고 그 문과 계단?
And also doors and staircases are very important elements in the film. The sort of new world and new layer that opens up when you open a door and the meaning behind going up and down the stairs, it's very significant for this film. And so we discussed a lot about doors and stairs with the production designer and the cinematographer.
We're talking with director Bong Joon-ho about his new film Parasite, outdoors at the Telluride Film Festival. The poor family in Parasite are pretending to be people they're not. And part of the joke is they're better at doing those things than maybe the people this rich family would hire in terms of tutoring, in terms of driving. They're better than the people they would have ordinarily brought into their lives. They're totally qualified.
예리한 지적이에요. 그들이 사실 사지가 멀쩡해요.
That's a very sharp point because they're actually very properly normal and capable people. They're smart and they're capable, but despite that, they still don't have jobs. And I think that's the sad part about economic inequality all over the world these days. It's not that they're dumb and stupid that they don't have jobs.
And yet the Kims, the poor family, understand the rich family in ways that maybe the rich family doesn't even understand themselves. They have a way to assimilate and ingratiate themselves with that family that doesn't really work in the reverse direction, right? That they understand what privilege means and how to operate in that world, even though they have no experience in it.
아주 흥미로운 질문이고 내가 듣고 싶었던 얘기이기도 한데,
That's a very fascinating question, and it's a question that I wanted to hear. I think for the rich family, it's not that they can't understand. It's more that they just don't really want to know. The line about not crossing the line, it's about someone not liking someone intruding that line, but it's also about not wanting to look out beyond that line as well. All they want to see is their comfortable environment.
영화의 클라이막스 시퀀스에서도 아마 그걸 느낄 수 있을 거예요. 되게 빠르고 정신없게 펼쳐지는 시퀀스지만
And you really get a sense of that in the film's climax. It happens very fast and hectic, but you really see them operating within the lines that they arbitrarily draw for themselves. Even if something is like one inch beyond that line, they treat it as something that belongs to another universe, another world. And I think that's very intimately tied to the theme of this film.
When I think about Parasite, I think about The Host, I think about Snowpiercer, I think about Okja. There are so many fantastical elements to all of those films, and they're difficult to categorize, and yet they all seem to be about real-world issues. They can be about consumption, they can be about class struggle, they can be about families. Do you find, as a storyteller, that sometimes the more extreme a story becomes, the more real it can play?
내가 정치적인 영화를 만들어야 된다, 또는 무슨...
So it's not as if I intend to make a particularly political film with propaganda. My effort is always to delve into the really mundane, small, daily issues that surround me. But once I delve into those issues, I find myself ending up in a dark cave of capitalism. And so it doesn't happen because I want it to, but I just end up dealing with those issues.
My goal is always making funny movie.
Your film Snowpiercer was a critical success in China and abroad, but Parasite was recently removed from China's first film festival because of technical reasons. How do you think about how your film and this film in particular are received in different countries, even countries they may not welcome it?
중국은 항상 예측하기 힘들어서 또 그런 재미가 있는 것 같아요. 근데
China is always very difficult to predict, but we do have a Chinese distributor who acquired the film, and I think that they must have done it because they have certainty that it will be released in theaters, but you can never predict the government or the Communist Party's decisions for China, but I do hope that one day it can meet Chinese audiences.
Parasite became the first Korean film to win the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. What does that mean to the film? What does that mean to you? And what does that mean to Korean cinema?
모르겠어요. 한국 영화가 마침 또 100주년이었어요. 금년에. 그래갖고 century 뭐랄까 뭐.
So this year marks the 100th anniversary of Korean cinema, and a lot of people discuss this award as a historical gift to celebrate it. And I think it was an incredibly coincidental, amazing gift. But I do think that Korea should have received this award earlier. There have been a lot of amazing Korean film directors, like Kim Gi-young, who directed The Housemaid. And I think relatively compared to Japan and China, Korean films were spread to the Western world a little bit late. And of course, personally, I consider this award a huge honor, but I try my best to work so that before and after this award, things really haven't changed as much. Even before this award, I was working on 2-3 projects, and I'm trying to calmly continue on with those projects.
Sharon Choi and Bong Joon-ho, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Up next on The Frame, the Oscar-nominated costume designer for Jojo Rabbit takes us on a tour of her favorite costume house.
I guess I'll have to change my plan. I should have realized there'd be another man. I overlooked that.
The right costume can tell you a lot about characters in a movie, where they come from, what they aspire to, what they value, essentially who they are. Mayez Rubeo knows how clothes can more or less speak. Born in Mexico City, she's the first Latina nominated for an Academy Award in the costume design category. It's for her work on the World War II satire, Jojo Rabbit. Like any period film, this one required a lot of research. The Frame contributor Andrea Gutierrez has the story.
This is the Mecca of costumes in America, Western costume.
Mayez Rubeo is giving me a tour of Western Costume, a massive costume house in North Hollywood, right under the flight path for Burbank Airport. And it's clear she spent a lot of time here.
Hello, Jack. How are you? Good, thank you. Thank you. The best tailor in the whole town.
Rubeo is a costume designer. And this is not a store, it's an archive. Western Costume opened more than 100 years ago, and it's been making, renting out, and cataloging costumes ever since.
It's so fragile. They don't make this kind of lace anymore.
We're here in a windowless building among rows and rows of garments stacked 2 and 3 high. Rubeo is right at home among the racks.
This is an overall. I mean, look at this. This one, look at the tag. It's very old.
So, what does it say on the tag?
Well, no, this is when they marked it, but this come a lot earlier.
1939, yeah, maybe.
Probably.
This is where Rubeo did a lot of research for Jojo Rabbit. A so-called anti-hate satire about Nazi Germany seen through the eyes of a 10-year-old boy who sometimes gets advice from his imaginary friend, Adolf Hitler.
But now they call me a scared rabbit.
Let them say whatever they want. People used to say a lot of nasty things about me. Oh, this guy's a lunatic. Oh, look at that psycho. He's gonna get us all killed.
This is Rubeo's second film with writer and director Taika Waititi, who also plays the Nazi dictator.
Adolf, we like to call him Adolf. We don't like to use, you know, the H word.
The look of the film was key in establishing a child's viewpoint. Rubeo worked with Waititi, production designer Rob Vincent, and director of photography Mihai Malemari Jr. to develop the film's vivid color palette, especially when it comes to Jojo's mother, Rosie, played by Scarlett Johansson.
The colors that you see in Rosie Bensler are colors that are, you know, that the intention of her colors were to show how a child looks at his mother and what the memory is like. When you have a memory of your mother, a flash memory, all you remember is the more vibrant colors.
Bright colors and warm tones fade and turn cold as reality sinks in for Jojo. But it was Rubeo's love and extensive knowledge of textiles that really put her in the headspace of the characters.
We wanted to show pieces that they were loved to her and every character of the movie. Every character should have a piece that it means so much to them.
For Rosie, what was the piece that meant the most to her?
I think that green sweater.
Rosie's sweater looks cozy, lived in. It's got a bold zigzag pattern in brown and blue against a mint green background. There's a hand-knit quality to it, while also being chic. Wearing it, Rosie stands in stark contrast to Jojo in his khaki uniform of his fictionalized Nazi youth group.
I wanted to think that she got that sweater because Sonia Delaunay had the exhibit and said, oh, look, you should wear this.
There's no bigger inspiration for Rosie's style than the Ukrainian-French artist Sonia Delaunay. Her bold textile designs of the early 20th century might have been known to an artist type like Rosie, and is echoed in the zigzag of her sweater. Rubeo mapped out an entire backstory for Rosie. She was an actress in an important theater company, her friends were all artists, and she liked to go dancing in her distinctive two-toned shoes. But it wasn't until the last minute that the color of her shoes was decided.
Until the day before shooting, the first time the shoes, we were undecided, indecisive of like, what do we do? Then Taika said, that's it, we're going for the red shoes.
Rubeo collects textiles wherever she travels, from flea markets around the world. They're like oils for her canvas. Her memory of them is encyclopedic. It's that knowledge and her familiarity with the great costume houses of Italy and Germany that gave her the tools to know which pieces to rent and which to make.
This is the most creative part of Western costume. This is where all these ladies, like Nancy and all these Jose, they all have been in Western costume for such a long time. They execute our sketches.
This sensibility of constructing and deconstructing is something Rubeo has cultivated since she was a child growing up in Mexico City.
I think I was about 5. You know, when we were like playgrounds, we were a group of little girls and we would play anything, but I always wanted to say, yes, but first we're going to dress up for that. No, we don't have time for that. Let's just play. No, we have to get into the costumes. So, you know, have to put them into the costumes before we were playing any game.
Maíz Castillero, as she was then known, was only 20 when she moved to Los Angeles in the early 80s. She couldn't afford her dream school, so she ended up at Trade Tech, a community college, which probably gave her a better understanding of pattern making and garment construction than she might otherwise have gotten. She ended up in Italy because of Bruno Rubeo, her husband and an accomplished production designer himself, who passed away in 2011. He was one of her greatest cheerleaders as she worked her way up in costume design and would no doubt revel in her current success.
He'll be organizing parties and make it, you know, all kinds of crazy, wonderful things to celebrate. He will be very proud, yeah.
Proud of her Academy Award nomination. For The Frame, I'm Andrea Gutierrez.
And one final note about Jojo Rabbit costumer Maya's Rubeo. She already won the prize for excellence in period film from the Costume Designers Guild. And that'll do it for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.